Welcome, everybody, to the Steers Real Estate Podcast. My name is Matt Seifer, the director of the Steers Center for Global Real Estate at Georgetown University's McDonough School of Business. Very, very happy today to have one Tyler Rosenlicht with us today. Tyler is a senior vice president and portfolio manager in the global listed infrastructure area of Cohen & Steers and is the head of the natural resource strategies execution within Cohen & Steers. And ironically, he's been at Cohen & Steers since July 2012, which was precisely the same month that I started at Georgetown University. And in fact, when I was interviewing, I think we slapped hands on the way through, and he was exiting Georgetown with his MBA, and I was coming in to get things started here. So have kept tabs on Tyler and his career over those 10 years, and he's steadily progressed, and we're very proud of where he's at from a position and responsibility standpoint right now. So Tyler, very much appreciate you being here, and you know, thanks for making the time.
I appreciate the opportunity. Look forward to the conversation.
Well, good, man. So let's get started a little bit. I think it's always important for our listeners to, you know, get to know a little bit about who you are. So give us a bit about your background. Where are you from? You know, where'd you go to school other than Georgetown, of course? Get us sort of level set here.
Yeah. So happy to kind of go through the meandering path. So I grew up outside Hartford in central Connecticut. Wanted to go somewhere down in the mid-Atlantic for undergrad and ended up going to University of Richmond, where I did a double major in political science and economics. And I was one of those sort of classic junior seniors in college who didn't know what I wanted to do. So thought that I should go to law school, took the LSATs in sort of the spring, the fall of my senior year. And then this was back in 2006, the fall of 2006, talking to a bunch of my friends who were in the business school, who were interviewing for investment banking, getting these great investment banking offers that were offering them a whole bunch of money. And I said, that might be kind of interesting. Let me see if I can sort of finagle one of these investment banking analyst roles, try that out. If I don't like it, I can go to law school, you know, a couple of years down the road. So this was back sort of at sort of peak economy in the mid-2000s, when anybody who, you know, was willing to give it a shot could get an offer from an investment bank. And I kind of got lucky with my timing. I was given a couple different investment banking opportunities, actually. And the one that I chose was with what was Wachovia in their real estate investment banking group. So right out of school, I did have an interest in real estate. And it so happened that the real estate investment banking group for Wachovia was headquartered in Richmond, got to know them, and then was sort of given the opportunity to go and spend a few years as an analyst there. Had a really good experience. Obviously, you know, it was a pretty interesting time, graduating in 2007. Yep. Being the sort of end of the bull market, transition to the financial crisis. And I sort of moved with some of the managing directors that I worked with to another firm, really enjoyed it. But I kind of woke up after 3 years and said, hey, I'm ready to take a little step back, reassess things, love finance, but maybe want to get on the buy side, change sort of what I'm focused on a little bit. So decided to go back to grad school. And when I was thinking about grad school programs, you know, I was very interested in the idea of leveraging my real estate background, but focusing on infrastructure, which was very much a, you know, up and coming sector of the capital markets. You know, I really liked real estate, the tangibility of it, and the ability to sort of predict cash flows and leases and so forth, but said, hey, I'm kind of interested in how the world works, and infrastructure is about moving people and moving energy and moving goods and powering the economy. And what I also liked about it was it very much bridged the gap between government and business. A lot of infrastructure is regulated businesses and so forth. And so one of those folks who went back to grad school with the intention of studying to get a job in infrastructure. And I thought no better place than Georgetown, because the sort of intersection of government and finance and all that comes with that made a lot of sense to me. So to fast forward, I did 2 years at Georgetown, had an unbelievably good experience, actually interned with Cohen & Steers between my first and second years, and then was given the opportunity to join full-time in, I guess, the fall of 2012 or the summer of 2012 after graduation, and have been there ever since. And I've seen my career kind of progress, you know, really nicely. I started as an analyst covering energy infrastructure pipeline companies and now help oversee all of our listed infrastructure strategies as well as natural resource equities as a separate part of our real assets platform.
Awesome, man. Well, that's a great story. And again, we're certainly proud of what you've been able to accomplish and continue to accomplish. So let's jump in a little bit. Obviously, Georgetown is creating what is known as a Master's of Science in Global Real Assets. And by way of a little bit of an advertisement, we are starting this program in August of 2023, with our first cohort. And this concept of real assets is a bit of a departure from what you typically see in these graduate programs that are focused principally on real estate. And so the Steer Center and the McDonough School of Business have partnered on a MS in Global Real Assets. And so what I was hopeful you could spend a little bit of time with us on is, how does Cohn and Steers broadly define the term real assets? And maybe then how does infrastructure, which is your area, fit into that definition?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, when we think about what we want to invest in as a firm, one thing that we firmly do not want to do is sort of be something for everyone, right? We don't believe in this sort of style box, large cap value, small cap growth approach to investing. For us, it's very much about finding something that we think represents unique strategies where active management can really generate alpha, investors can see really good returns, and we can do a better than average job managing portfolios on their behalf. You know, we were founded, obviously, as the first manager of REIT Mutual Fund, founded back in 1986, I believe. I think Bob Steers would say they were right, but early. It took, you know, 7 or 8 years for the listed REIT markets to really take off. But in the early 90s, obviously REITs became a much more popular investment. And, you know, for us, you know, real estate at its core is the part of a real asset, which is, you know, something that's tangible, something that can have positive returns in an inflationary environment, something that is sort of durable, high barrier to entry, predictable supply and demand, predictable cash flows, all those characteristics. And so for us, as a firm back in about 2010, we sort of said, I say we, but obviously Bob Steers and Joe Harvey, our current CEO, and Marty Cohen, the other co-founder, wanted to expand sort of what we do from a real assets perspective. And we said, hey, a lot of people focus on growth or they focus on value. For us, it's about focusing on businesses that we think, you know, again, have really good competitive advantages, predictability, and so forth, and have good inflation sensitivity. And so, you know, in the being early case, we were early back then too, thinking that, hey, you know, we've been in a disinflationary world for a long time. Well, let's prepare for an inflationary one, which obviously we've started to see over the course of the last 18 months. But how do we define it? We define it pretty simplistically. It's kind of four key investment strategies. Investment strategy one is global real estate. That is sort of the preeminent key long-term real asset that folks are comfortable with. The second one is global listed infrastructure, which I can walk through the investment characteristics there. But we invest in things like transportation, airports, marine ports and toll roads, utilities, telecommunications like cell towers and data centers, energy pipeline. Our third major category is commodities. Obviously, when we're thinking about real assets, we're thinking about, you know, an inflation protection. Commodities have a very good track record of performing well in inflationary periods. And then the fourth is natural resource equities. So the businesses that are actually in the extractive industries or that help us sort of pursue the energy transition from a resource base and a minerals base and so forth. So it's those four sort of key sectors. And honestly, they're very similar. They're very different. They're very complementary, but for us, they represent sort of ways that investors can strategically and long-term position for inflationary worlds and for sort of global economic growth that have a diversification benefit and can perform well when maybe stocks and bonds are performing poorly. So maybe what I'd end with, when we think about real assets, I mean, a lot of investors broadly have very much been focused on the sort of 60-40 equities and bonds portfolios. And sort of what we've tried to say is most of the time that 60-40 blend can do pretty well, but there's sometimes when it does really poorly. And we think about real assets as being sort of a new slice that you want to put into your investment allocation permanently to sort of supplement that sort of traditional 60-40 portfolio, if that makes sense.
Yeah, makes great sense. So you spent you said it a couple of times, but you've indicated that the infrastructure piece of this and real estate, because they're very similar in how they behave, is an inflation hedge, or is you know, particularly valuable during the inflationary times that we find ourselves in right now. So can you talk a little bit about the mechanics of how it is actually an inflation hedge?
Yeah, it's a great question. And we've spent a lot of time historically analyzing it. And then it's nice to sort of see the sort of fruits of that labor and that analysis play out, at least for infrastructure over the course of last year. So when I take a step back, for me as an investor, like all investors, I think what we're looking for are businesses that are able to earn a return in excess of their cost of capital. In theory, if you can earn in excess of your cost of capital, you're generating economic profit that can accrue to shareholders and, you know, produce good returns over time, obviously, you know, can factor in risk. When I think about infrastructure, or take a step back, when I think about any business in an inflationary world, I think those that perform well have four key characteristics. So characteristic number one would be, do they have pricing power? And in an inflationary world, costs are going up. Are you as a business able to increase the cost you charge to your customers and have your top line grow commensurate with inflation or faster than inflation? The second thing would be, you want a high margin business, because if you've got high margins in an inflationary world, you can handle increased costs better than a low margin company. The third factor would be fixed costs versus variable costs. Are you predominantly fixed costs that aren't going to rise with inflation? Or do you have a lot of variable costs where you're going to have to pay people a whole lot more, and that's going to sort of weigh on your margins as well? And then the last component would be, typically in an inflationary world, interest rates are also rising. And so you want to have long-term fixed rate debt or a balance sheet that's not going to face lots of interest rate risk or refinancing risk and so forth. So broadly speaking, in an inflationary world, you want those characteristics. REITs oftentimes have them. Infrastructure does as well. You know, one of the biggest differences between infrastructure and real estate is the nature of how they generate revenues and sort of the business that they're in. I mean, there's a spectrum of infrastructure businesses, but a large component is the utility space, or, you know, true monopolies that are able to increase revenues commensurate with inflation because of regulation. And so they are allowed to truly pass on all these increased costs to their customers by law. That makes it really important to understand regulatory risk. I mean, that is the risk that keeps me up as an infrastructure investor, making sure that I know the rules aren't going to change or regulatory policy is not going to be altered. That's definitely happened more and more over the last 18 months. But when I go through those four characteristics, I mean, infrastructure businesses, they're monopolistic, high barrier to entry, they have pricing power, they are large assets, they cost a whole lot to build, not as much to run, higher margin, fixed versus variable costs, they oftentimes have a lot of fixed costs. And then one of the nice things about infrastructure today, which is a little bit different than 2008, is the balance sheets are in really good shape. And so we see sort of leverage at very reasonable levels with lots of sort of long-term fixed rate financing. And so it makes sense to me that, hey, infrastructure should do well. It's a link to the global economy. Rising inflation usually means economic growth, but also the underlying characteristics and the historical performance bears it out, you know, a very solid performance history in an inflationary world.
So that's great. And I've taken a bunch of notes on that and you know, very well broken down. So obviously you're over the natural resources area specifically, but what do you like a lot as a company within infrastructure today? I mean, there's a lot of investable opportunities right now. What do you like the most?
It's a great question. And I'd say there's so much conflicting macro data today that's making it harder than ever, I think, to have a really convicted view on sort of where we are in the cycle and what's going to do really well. You know, maybe I'll start with sort of what is our current macro view on the world, and then I'll tell you something that we like in that context. So our macro view on the world is, clearly there's a lot of economic concern. Global economy is slowing. We think we are going to be in a recession later this year, maybe next year. Not going to be a severe recession. It's more of a modest recession, although obviously the sort of banking crises that we're seeing pop up here makes it a little bit scarier. We think inflation is going to be fairly high, higher than average in the next decade versus the last decade. But I'd say that feels very much sort of like the financial economy and the financial asset world. The real economy itself actually feels okay. We're seeing very strong sort of labor wages, consumer spending. We are seeing major trends with nearshoring, with deglobalization, with supply scarcity and so forth. And so for us, there's sort of like the blue collar economy and then the sort of white collar economy. And they're in very different places today. White collar struggling, blue collar doing a lot better. So what's one thing that we like in infrastructure? And this kind of goes contrary to what you typically want to own into a recession. We really like the freight rail. I mean, freight rails are businesses that have incredibly good pricing power. They have irreplaceable networks. I mean, the rail track that we have in North America is never can be replaced or competed away. We think there's lots of desire to nearshore manufacturing as we try to rely less on Russia and China and other regions. And we think sort of the movement of goods is going to continue. So good pricing power, reasonable volume growth, high high margins, generating a lot of free cash flow. There's some activism in the space today as well. So that's a good example of sort of an infrastructure business, sort of how we think about the macroeconomy and how it could affect it. And something that we think actually is positioned reasonably well here.
Well, I love it. I got a follow-up question I want to ask you offline on that one. But so what opportunities do you see for students who are coming out of, whether it's our undergraduate programs or MBA programs or the new program we're offering here in this general real assets area? I mean, a question I get a lot, frankly, is who are the employers coming out of this new graduate degree program? And my view is it's probably the same employers it's always been. It's just some different areas within the company focusing on things that maybe have been non-traditional. And maybe some of these companies are expanding their definition of what's investable and consequently will need people that will have a better understanding of that. So where do you think the job opportunities are? And I am putting you on the spot here, and I'm joking, we can maybe edit this out if need be, but it's a tough time in the marketplace right now from a hiring perspective generally. Do you think there may be more opportunities in the infrastructure area generally, or what's your view on that?
Yeah, you know, the reality is for real assets broadly, it's been a challenging investment world for the last 20 years. I mean, we saw tech eat everybody's lunch. We saw such growth and wealth accumulation and opportunities in all of these other sectors. We can say kind of why was that? You know, there's a whole lot of reasons, but we've been in like a disinflationary world where, you know, real assets candidly have been out of favor. I mean, no one's wanted to invest in commodities for a long time. Real estate and infrastructure bucked the trend a little bit. Resource equities, nobody's been interested in for a number of years either. And so what I would say is, like, if I was a student and I was thinking about like the investment opportunity, kind of where's capital going? Where are good returns going? And with it, where will jobs and career growth and opportunities go? I think real assets is a really interesting place to be. I mean, not to sort of litter this with my own views on the global economy, but we've just had 20 years of very low inflation. I think we're going to a decade plus of higher average inflation. That's going to be really good for returns in real assets businesses. For a student coming out of school, like, you know, what does it mean? I mean, the opportunity set and sort of functionally what you can do across real assets, I think, is really broad and really interesting. I mean, if you have a desire to be on the public-private partnership side, on the, you know, development bank side, on the government policy side, I mean, just look last year, the Inflation Reduction Act, I mean, Congress is talking about this and passing bills, all stuff that's tangential or important for real assets. If you're a finance person, I mean, private equity funds, asset managers like ourselves, investment banks, this is an area of growth where other places are going to see maybe worse returns relative and some shrinking. And honestly, within companies, I mean, across real assets, there's just really cool things going on. We'll probably talk a little bit about the energy transition and decarbonization and ESG and all the good stuff that's happening there. But there's just a lot of dynamism across companies in the real asset spectrum. I mean, you have, within my world, companies that are developing new battery technologies, that are working on carbon capture, working on hydrogen, and they're looking for smart students and for technical people and engineers and finance folks and policy folks to help them navigate what's a major shift in how energy is created and transmitted and consumed. That's just one small example. So, I mean, not to be sort of too bullish real assets, but, you know, it's a big all-encompassing world of really interesting things that I think is going to continue to grow over the course of the next few decades, because candidly, it has to, as the global economy grows and as the developing market, you know, sees rising wealth, and as the developed world, you know, needs to sort of fix what we've got and make it cleaner, more efficient, more productive, you name it.
So I love that. So I think I know the answer to this, but I would assume, given everything you've described in the inflationary environment that we find ourselves, the capital appetite for these products is significant, right? Or can you describe the capital appetite for real assets today?
Yeah, let me use infrastructure as the example. So when I started in the summer of 2012, I think we managed about $2.7 billion or so. And that made us one of the larger managers of infrastructure. So fast forward about 11 years, we now manage, I think, about $8.5 billion. It hasn't been linear. Like the first 5 years, we saw sort of a slow and steady growth in our business. Over the last 5 years, and particularly the last two or three, it's really started to accelerate. I think it was easy to sort of not focus on these sectors for a while when Microsoft and Amazon and Apple and all those other businesses were doing really well. And I think there's a real sort of perception now that the regime is changing, or it has changed, or it might be changing. And so within our world, we're seeing appetite from retail investors via our mutual funds. We are seeing appetite from institutional investors, which runs the gamut from university endowments, from sovereign wealth funds, from pension funds, you name it. And so, you know, we as a firm, and I personally believe that this is an area where capital is going to continue to accumulate because it's a good investment, because the macro cycle is set up really well, we think, for it, and because the sort of risk return outlook is very favorable. And so we've seen it accelerate, and I don't see anything, you know, knock on wood, that would say, hey, we're going to see this, you know, put the brakes on and turn in reverse by any means.
Got it. So I love that. You had mentioned alternative energy and energy transition in a prior portion of this conversation. So how does alternative energy enter into your world as a head of natural resource equities?
You know, it's the thing I'm probably focused on more than anything else today. And some people would say, hey, that seems in conflict. You know, natural resources, as we look at it, includes metals and mining, oil and gas and energy, and then agribusiness. Energy transition would seem to sort of be trying to disintermediate energy or traditional energy or you name it. I guess my sort of core view on this, everybody wants a cleaner energy system. I mean, we all want to have the most productive, cheapest, cleanest energy that we can have. The reality is we're, you know, fighting a couple different trends. I mean, trend number one is the world just needs a whole lot more energy. We are seeing developed worlds grow very slowly, but the developing world see a massive increase in their needs to consume energy and massive needs to produce that energy from clean forms and from traditional forms as well. So how does it sort of manifest in my sort of natural resource equities seat? Well, we're thinking about what is the long-term demand for oil? When's it going to peak? What is the sort of eventual decline going to look like? How does natural gas fit in as a transition fuel? What I think is really interesting, we think that the growth opportunity in solar, wind, and other renewables is immense. That's going to pull a lot of demand from what I would call transition metals. So metals that fuel the energy transition, things like copper, aluminum, cobalt, lithium, not a metal, but all of these different inputs required to electrify the global energy system is very relevant to the natural resources space. Again, not to be political, but like we're bullish nuclear and what that means for energy production and the demand for uranium and so forth. I guess at its core, I think natural resource equities, I think infrastructure, I think even real estate, I think a lot of what we do can facilitate the energy transition and can be big beneficiaries of all these trends that are happening. And we can play it from different angles and with different sort of motivations and different sort of perspectives. And obviously predicting the future is impossible, but this energy transition is happening. And I think it's going to be very meaningful for sort of prospective returns and sort of winners and losers as it plays out over the course of a few decades. It's not going to be a short, quick path.
Well, and maybe related to that, this is all sort of could be wrapped up in this ESG concept, environmental, social, and governance. And Bob Steers has been very influential in the way we think about it within the Steers Center here. And ESG is not a product, right? It's infused within everything we do. And frankly, it comes down a lot to issues of risk management, right? And you'd think about, in my view, and how you underwrite the credit risk of a tenant is not dissimilar to how you would underwrite some risk associated with any of those three categories. So how does Cohen & Steers think about issues of ESG relative to the investments you're making across the firm?
Yeah, we've spent a lot of time focused on ESG for a really long time. It's not something that's new to us. I mean, we were listed on the stock exchange in 2003 as a firm, and I think have always cared a lot about governance and incentives and sort of managing our own business properly and using that as a lens with which we analyze the businesses that we invest in. For me, let's take infrastructure and resources as well. I don't think that you can invest in a company in the infrastructure space if you don't have a deep fundamental understanding of the ESG components of that business. I mean, the best two examples that I can give you would be, you know, we invest in energy pipelines. If a company does not maintain its energy pipelines and there's a spill, that is a serious problem for the environment and for the business and the equity value of the business. And you could see a permanent capital impairment if they aren't maintaining assets correctly, if they aren't diversifying their business, if they're not open to the energy transition and making sure that their business doesn't degrade to zero. So it's key. You know, in the utility space, you know, these are regulated monopolies providing power and light and heat to their customers. If they don't have good social relationships with their constituents and with their regulators, I mean, they're going to have worse ROEs and worse growth opportunities. So for me, like, I think we spend a lot of time quantitatively thinking about ESG, and we rank every company and we score them and we analyze them from an ESG perspective, because I do think you need to do that and sort of surface it, bring it to the fore. But it's also embedded in all of our thinking and all of our valuations and our expectations for growth rates. I guess to me, maybe my one sort of interesting perspective on ESG, or kind of what I think will happen over the course of the next decade or so, is I kind of think ESG is going to become very similar to credit rating. So, you know, over time, you've had a couple of sort of companies that provide credit ratings to REITs, to banks, to basically every company. And they sort of are the industry bellwethers. And they say, this company is A rated, this is BBB rated, this is BB rated. And a lot of investors spend a whole lot of time saying, are the agencies wrong? Is this company going to get downgraded? I can then make an investment on it. Are they going to get upgraded? I can make an investment on that. I actually think ESG is going to be kind of similar. We're going to converge to a few third-party providers of ESG scores. And then we as investors can spend a lot of time being really thoughtful and trying to figure out how we disagree or how we think differently than the agencies. And maybe we find a company that has a poor ESG score that we think should get upgraded and might get upgraded. And that's going to improve their cost of capital, improve their growth rate, and improve their investor base. That becomes a really good alpha lever. Similarly, there's a company that gets a good score, but we think their governance is really bad and their incentives are really bad. And so we're going to position based on sort of the common market perception and our own sort of divergent views. And so that's one way I think ESG will evolve. I mean, it's not going anywhere, but it's also been here for a really long time. It's just becoming a little bit more formal. And I think as an active manager looking for, you know, returns that are better than average, you know, if we can be more thoughtful than others and forward thinking, I kind of welcome all that we're seeing from an ESG perspective.
So, and I don't want to dwell too much, but, you know, the politics of that have become pretty fierce, and you'll have certain states that are prohibiting their, whatever the pension fund is within their state, from investing in some of this stuff, right? And so, you know, how do you navigate what I think of as sort of an immaturity of this process that will evolve over time and you know, develop the credibility that it needs based on a lot of the things you just said? But how do you think about the political piece of this thing and, frankly, the risk associated with the politics?
Yeah, it's a really tough question to answer. I mean, I think it had become very easy to be, we say ESG, but I think a lot of sort of what people are focused on is energy. And they're saying, hey, we want a clean energy system that's decarbonized for the good of the climate, which, again, I, like everybody, aspires to and wants to see happen. It was very easy for the last, well, from about 2 years ago to 7 years ago, to be very pro decarbonization and anti-traditional energy, for instance, and see really good returns, because energy returns were really bad and all the other returns were really good. Now it's becoming a little bit trickier, because energy returns, traditional energy returns, as traditional energy businesses have changed their business models over the last 5 years, have actually generated really good returns. And at least in the short term, there's been a financial performance trade-off for someone that screens out energy companies, as an example. Are they willing, should they be willing to sort of give up some return in that sort of from that sort of perspective? You know, I think every investor is welcome to invest however they want. I think as sort of like policymakers enact, you know, regulations and so forth, I think it becomes a little bit trickier. I guess, you know, maybe the one sort of controversial thing that I would say, or maybe as I have this forum to speak a little bit about my own beliefs, I think what I think is, from an energy perspective, we need a lot more of it. I think it's okay to trade bad coal, for instance, for cleaner natural gas as a transition to emission-free wind and solar. And so I would hope that there's a growing willingness, I think, to not be zero sum. Hey, if we can make something a little bit better for a while and then make something even better in the long run, let's be willing to go down that path. Maybe I'll pause there before I get myself in too much trouble.
I get you, man. Well, so I'm going to ask you a question I have not prepared you for. One of our classic interview questions that everybody seems to get is, if you had X $100 million today, where would you put it and why? So you obviously have a book that you believe in. So if you had $150 million today, where would you put it and why?
Yeah, so I'm really biased. We do eat our own cooking and we sort of invest in things that we believe in. I guess let me start from the top and tell you kind of why I'm going to go where I go. I think the regime has changed a lot, and I think we have exited what I call the era of abundance. And I'm talking specifically about commodities, but really all the stuff we need for the global economy to run. So we had very low interest rates. We had very low energy costs. We had abundant minerals and metals and sort of you name it. And I think we're entering an era of scarcity, cost of capital going up, deglobalization, less inventories, all that comes with it. So this era of scarcity is coming at a time when the demand for stuff like transition metals, which is where I'm going, the demand is going to be really strong because of the energy transition that we just spent a lot of time talking about. So where would I invest my $150 million, my hypothetical treasure chest? To me, it's on the picks and shovels of the energy transition, which I think of as copper and aluminum and sort of the other inputs that are going to be required to pursue where we all hope to go from a clean energy perspective. I look at the demand, I look at the supply, I look at the inflationary world we're in, and then I look at the valuations of some of these businesses. And I just say, hey, as a long-term secular investment, that seems fairly mispriced.
Well, Tyler Rosenlicht from Cohen & Steers, we certainly appreciate your time here today. I thought this was an excellent conversation. We've been trying to get this done for a while, so I'm glad we were able to squeeze it in. So really appreciate you making the time.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for the opportunity, and hopefully I'll see you down on campus soon.
You are always welcome. All right, take care.
Have a good one.